Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dice, Dirk the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files, for your eyes only, talking bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day. I'm coming live from a secret safe house somewhere in Bolton, the UK. I'm on the run, between locations, a moving target. I'm surrounded by my stuff, packed in sealed containers, and a zipped-up sports bag is my great library of RPGs and my Grognard Files. Thankfully, I still have my ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. I'll just give it a little tap. Ah yes, a gold lamé bikini and death in her eyes. She's Naomi, the vicious assassin from The Spy Who Loved Me. It can only mean one thing. The featured game of this episode of the Grognard Files is the TSR classic Top Secret, an espionage role-playing game for three or more players. This is the first in what I'm going to refer to as our spy sequence planned over the next year. It will be followed by Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes, the James Bond role-playing game, and Knight's Black Agent. Inside this episode, I'll try to explain how our overly complicated audience participation will mean that you can choose a game to feature in an actual play. It's extremely complicated, but more about that later. I love the potential of RPGs that feature elements of espionage. I like the sleight of hand involved in tradecraft. I like the possibilities of narratives that weave in real-world events and locations. And I like the purity of a mission-based structure and the unambiguous chain of command as a means of motivation. Over the years, I've used elements stolen from espionage and intrigue stories to spice up my swords and sorcery and horror games. So, before we get into that, I've had another iTunes review. Please do take the time to write one, as it sticks our cockles in the microwave for a reassuring ping. For me, what makes this podcast truly special is the way it candidly shares personal experiences with games mixed with solid information on the games. I also love the presenters spend time it takes to examine issues and products in detail rather than hurrying along. Many thanks for your outstanding work. Thanks for that, DJ Peterson 23662. It's appreciated. Good to know that we're striking the right balance for you. We've covered the big ones, the ones that we've played often, but as Rick Mint said in the previous episode, in the early 80s, games were coming out all of the time, and it was difficult to settle on one game. There were lots of games that we played once or twice, alongside the regulars, RuneQuest, Traveller and Stormbringer. Top Secret was one of those occasional games. In this one-part episode, we open the box on the game to reminisce on our earliest experiences playing the game. We also reflect on espionage games in general and how they've influenced our gaming group, the Armchair Adventurers. There's a brief potted history of this unusual and intriguing game before our resident rules lawyer, Judge Blythe, turns his attention on the finer points of the rules. I think he overrules me on a couple of occasions on this one. I've done a quick overview of the coverage of Top Secret in Dragon magazine and some of the rules editions that appeared in it. And we're also introducing a brand new section to the Grognard Files. Starburst Memories is an examination on how film and television has influenced our gaming experience. In a future episode, we've promised to look at Robin of Sherwood, the Hooded Man. Dum-dum. But here, we look at a couple of our favourite spy movies, and I try to explain that overly complicated audience participation thing I mentioned earlier. Please bear with me with that one. And the final section covers the details of our other projects and also a foretaste of what's coming next time. So, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Open box!
Welcome to Open Box, the section of the Grognard Files where we come together and look back to our earliest encounters of the RPG under discussion and reflect upon our own personal heritage with the game, as if it really matters. For this occasion, I've reconstructed the bedroom of our friend Simon, and over there in the corner, against a radiator, clutching a tiny bowl of crisp, it's Blythe. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
What are you doing down there?
I'm eating these crisps that Simon's generously offered me in a tiny bowl. They're always in a tiny bowl, weren't they?
They're always in a tiny
bowl. Never overdid it.
Yeah, so Simon, who was one of our earliest players, he was the games master for Top Secret, and Top Secret was Simon's game, and we would come into his bedroom and he would make us sit next to a radiator on the floor while he was in an elevated position on a chair.
Yes.
we'd be there like Terry Waite.
Well, so I was looking back on it, there's a lot of psychological stuff going on there, isn't there? Just sit on the floor with a very small bowl of crisps.
Between
just enough crisps to make you want more.
And he also had a handmade pyjama case in the shape of a green cat.
He did, didn't he? I think he saw that. It was like a bit Brideshead Revisited, wasn't it? You know, the character with the teddy bear in Brideshead Revisited. There's a bit of that, so I think it gave him a sense of being slightly upper class. Although it infuriated him when we put it on our head and said, look at me, I'm David Crockett.
Yeah, which we did on
regularly. Which we did on frequently.
Top Secret just appeared from nowhere.
All his games did. I think that was the odd thing about it, that we would go to Games Workshop and look at games and buy games and talk about getting games and what have you. But they just appeared, didn't they?
Yeah.
You know, Top Secret, and he had Gangbusters as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
And they just appeared from nowhere, and I thought, where did he buy them from?
Yeah, because we were with him a lot of the time, and
yeah, I don't think he had trips to Games Workshop on his own. They just appeared, didn't they? So whether he bought them mail order, we didn't like to ask. I don't know why, but we didn't. He felt rude to say, "Where the hell have you got this from?" As if he wasn't allowed to buy. As if he wasn't allowed any.
Which he wasn't. He wasn't really.
Wasn't allowed any autonomy. You know, we got him into role playing games. Therefore, he had to do what we wanted.
Yeah.
No, but it's putting us in a bad light.
But I think he used to have as well, he used to have a lot of war games, didn't he? So Avalon Hill war games.
Yeah.
I remember several afternoons playing Pay Dirt, which was a kind of reconstruction of American football.
American football's bad enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's controversial.
But playing it with little... Pay Dirt was like playing with little tiny cards.
Mm.
And you'd like do a whole season.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Oh,
it's like Sabutio without any of the fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so
that's American football, isn't it? It's like football without any of the fun.
So I've got here the box of Top Secret. And here's something of note. This isn't the original box. I got this one from Shop on the Borderlands.
Mm.
But I didn't get a dice with this when I got the box set. But I have the original dice. I have the original dice because, you know, remember mid 80s we had like Swapperama?
Oh, yeah.
Just get rid of stuff.
Yes, yeah.
I ended up with Top Secret. I don't know where it went. It probably just got cleared out when my mum cleared them all out. But I've got the dice. I've got the original dice.
The original dice.
And it's 20-sided D10. Do you remember when they were 20?
Oh, yeah, I've got one of those. Yeah. They're odd things, aren't they? Because it's a D20, but it goes from 1 to 1 to 0, or 0 to 9.
Yeah.
Twice, doesn't it?
That's it.
Yeah.
So you get that with it, and you get the rule book, and you get an adventure. And we actually played this adventure.
Mm.
It's Shrek and Harlan Stella. And essentially it's a dungeon.
a dungeon. James Bond style dungeon.
James Bond style dungeon where Eastern Europeans play the part of orcs. And it wouldn't surprise you to learn that this is full of tables, full of encounter tables. So Schreck and Harlandstella, it was a site in Germany where East and West would meet. And essentially, the player characters just go through the town, just killing everybody, really. I mean,
that's what we did. I don't remember. Did we do that? Probably did, didn't we?
We did, because I specifically remember us. It's got the thing about a magic carpet on here.
Mm, I remember that.
We were given a series of information of intel that could have been red herrings.
Yes, that's
right. Or could have been facts. So part of the shtick is that you don't know what's real and what's not.
Yes,
and,
yes.
So when you went into place, I think we went into a laundrette, didn't we?
Was it a laundrette or a... Yeah, it might have been a laundrette. And we asked you asked for a magic carpet.
I asked for a magic carpet.
And we went through his rigmarole with Simon, where Simon said, oh, really, you're going to ask for a magic carpet? And we said, yes. And he went, really, really? And looked at us like we were stupid. But of course, that was the code word. And you got taken to the back, weren't you? Yeah. Down in an elevator into some underground base or something like that, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that. Yeah.
I think we got frustrated with the game, though, because I seem to remember that. We had a bit of, you know, that thing where games masters kind of fall out with the players. I seem to remember that. I don't know whether we'd put the pyjama case on our head and
said we were Davy Crockett. Yeah. We might have done.
But I remember us ending up in prison or something.
Yes, I think we ended up in a prison in Czechoslovakia.
Before we leave Schreck and Harlandstella, I want to give you an example of some of the encounters that you might get in here to give you an idea of the flavour of it.
Yeah.
Okay. A midget disguised as a child will bounce a rubber ball towards the others to catch. If bounced or tossed back, she will approach and try to give a $100 bill. Okay. Are you going to take it?
Is this a spy game or a David Lynch film? What's going on? I think I vaguely remember this now. I think this is one of the reasons we fell out with him.
Yeah.
It was a bit weird. I wanted to be James Bond, and I felt like I was Agent Cooper in Twin Peaks.
If you don't give them a parcel or some object in return,
yeah,
you realise that it's not the right contact.
Okay.
And then we'll then try to recover the money by kicking you in the shin with a razor tip shoes.
Oh, that's a dad. They've nicked that, haven't they, from James Bond, haven't they?
They inflict one hit of damage per kick and are coated with arsenic poisoning. 39, 45, 24, 100, 105, 101, stroke, 103, 101, 103, stroke 6.
Is that a code? Is that a secret code? Or is it a table to be rolled on?
I think that's the stuff.
It's not a secret call. I think that's one of the reasons that we didn't get along with it then, because there were lots of things like that that felt a bit weird. And you didn't... I think in fairness to Simon and in fairness to us, it's that thing again that we come back to time and time again when we discuss games, isn't it? That we were quite young. I mean, we were probably 13 or 14 years old, weren't we, when we played this? And some of the subtleties might have been lost on us.
Okay. Fast forward to now, right? To this day. And I said to you, right, I really want to run an espionage game.
Yes.
I'm like, okay. Would you go for it? Because the only reason I asked that is because I'm more enthusiastic about playing spies and espionage games. Than you and Eddie. I feel rightly or wrongly that you kind of humour me when it comes to doing that.
Well, the thing with espionage as a genre is that, I mean, it's true of any genre, isn't it? But maybe more so when it comes to espionage is that there's different sub-genres of it, isn't there? I mean, depends what you mean, doesn't it? James Bond is one thing. Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is another. Michael Caine as Harry Palmer.
But if,
is another. Jason Bourne is another. They're all in that kind of area, but they're all in some ways very different in the way that they played out.
I still think, though, that even if I pitched to you and Eddie, and I have done, haven't I, because with Knights Black Agents, I pitched to you the idea that it's in a modern day contemporary setting and you're gonna play super spies in a like Jason Bourne. I don't see the same thrill in your eyes as if I said I've got an 18-month campaign which you'll play a wizard moving through a fantasy realm.
Have you? Have you got one of those?
I haven't got one of those. I've got Knights Black Agents, Dracula Dockers.
Well, Knights Black Agents is all right, but again, you're cheating slightly there because I suppose, I'm kind of supporting your argument a little bit. Knights Black Agents is appealing because it's got vampires in it. But it's not quite pure espionage, is it?
No.
And I think you could be right. I'm a little bit cold on the... I'm sort of setting myself up here now, aren't I? So I'm almost admitting I don't really like spy role-playing. But then again, I don't know if we ever played a good game of espionage role-playing. I don't know if we have, because I think... I know what you're saying, but then we've played games, we've played fantasy games, we've played games of RuneQuest, we've played games of D&D, we've played fantasy games, which have had an element of espionage in it.
Yeah.
We've had, for example, you know, we did a, it's not quite espionage, but it's in the same ballpark. You know, we've done detective stuff in Pervis, haven't we, years ago when we were young.
Yeah.
We did that. We did one that you did about a serial killer in RuneQuest called the Basilisk. You know, so named that anyone who saw him or her never lived to tell the tale. That was a little bit espionage in terms of, you know, you don't know who to trust. Those elements of espionage things that are appealing, aren't they? You know, who to trust, deceiving people, you know, not being honest with them. All that stuff can be there in fantasy games or science fiction games or any game, can't it? And I think this is the problem, that what you're talking about is a system, a game system, purely revolving around the genre of espionage, which is slightly different.
See, I don't think, I mean, I think that kind of proves what I feel, and that's that spies are not really a genre, are they? Espionage isn't really a genre. I think that's part of the difficulty, and when we come to looking a bit more, that's part of the difficulty. I think it's more of a style than a type, if you see what I mean. So you can get a style of, like you said, in fantasy setting, you can get a style of espionage.
Yeah.
What Top Secret does is, its key selling point early on, it says that this is the first modern role-playing game set here in the here and now.
Set in the 80s with the Cold War and all that kind of stuff going on.
Yeah, and those kind of conspiracies. Yes. And I find that that's the bit that's the hard sell. You know, the setting, unless it's in a fantastic setting, having that kind of contemporary world is always difficult to sell.
Well, yeah, but then we live in that anyway, don't we? You know me. If I can't be a wizard, I'm not happy. I think you've got a point, I think. Yeah, so it's not really espionage that you're talking about, is it? Because you can have that in lots of games. You can have espionage. You could be a spy in RuneQuest, couldn't you?
Yeah.
You know, you could be a spy in Traveller. You could be a spy in any game and build in all those elements of espionage and develop a plot where there's not a shot fired, but it's all about, you know, infiltration and deception and that kind of thing. I think, you know, you could do it in Call of Cthulhu, couldn't you? You could infiltrate some cultists as a spy.
Yeah.
That'd be a good story, that'd be exciting. But yeah, I suppose you're right. The thing that me and Eddie tend to be a bit cool on is the idea of setting it in the absolute here and now, in a kind of real setting where there's no element of fantasy whatsoever.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what Top Secret does is that. It's not fantasy. I mean, you could say it's fantasy in terms of the things it talks about are not really how it works, you know.
Yeah.
But it's still set in the real world. And you're right, it does, I mean, we might be corrected by people listening, but it does feel like it's the first real world role-playing game.
Yeah.
You know, and that is a bit of a hard sell, isn't it? Because I suppose even at the time, in the 80s, you know, you had games where you could be a space pirate or a wizard or whatever else, and then someone comes along with, well, you can be a spy.
Yeah, and I just think it's important to make that point, because I think that'll set the context for when we look at the rules, that it's in the context of trying to, it's a hard sell.
Yeah, it is a hard sell, yeah.
Take it from me.
Yeah, do frequently.
Maybe I should adopt Simon's approach and just appear with...
Just appear with a game.
Yeah, we're playing this.
Yeah.
I think that kind of... I only mention that because I think that puts the line in the sand for when we...
line in the sand.
In the metaphorical sand as we discuss the rules. Do you realise it's 35 years on? So that means that our player characters will be released.
They would have been released, so we could have another game with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we should.
We should, yeah. Go on then. you convinced me. You finally won me over. I can bring that character back, even though I can't remember his name or anything about him.
Potted history! On the 17th of January 1980, two FBI agents arrive at TSR's downtown Lake Geneva offices. They're investigating a tip-off of an assassination plot in Beirut, Lebanon, of one William Weatherby. The agents have in their possession a piece of headed notepaper that has led them to the TSR offices. It's a series of notes made by Mike Carr, TSR's production manager, for an in-house top-secret game that he's running. A well-meaning Lake Geneva resident found the cryptic piece of paper and handed it over to the authorities, as any upstanding citizen would do. This apocryphal tale was often quoted back in the day as a mark of the authenticity of Top Secret, the role-playing game. In the opening blurb, the game declared, "In the last several years, there have been quite a few role-playing games produced, covering subjects as diverse as bunnies and bugbears, musketeers and mutants, even spacemen and cowboys. Most of these games are quite good, but there's an era missing. Today, no one has come up with rules for modern role-playing game, not set in the hazy future or the dim past, but the crystal-clear world of the here and now." Well, it's a bold claim, a claim that's possibly challenged by SBI's Dallas RPG, based on the soap opera. Nevertheless, Top Secret was the first modern age RPG that found an audience and was incredibly popular on its release. Not bad for a game that originated in a sophomore dorm. Merle Rasmussen was 18 when he first encountered D&D as a student at Iowa State University, where he was reading civil engineering. He enjoyed war games and diplomacy, and D&D attracted his attention. After a couple of games, he was struck by the potential of the concept of role-playing. He wasn't too bothered about the fantasy, but he saw it as an opportunity to play out some of his interests in espionage serials such as The Avengers or The Man from U.N.C.L.E. He took on the role of both games master and player character and referred to himself as the administrator, as he pitted his wits against his roommate, who took on the persona of James Pong Thompson, an assassin with a really big gun. Merle would set up sessions and missions, and James Pong, a ruthless sadist, would compete against his characters, breaking into the administrator's block, stealing his secrets, assassinating his characters. It became a man-on-man conflict, spy versus spy. His roommate suggested that he write up the game and send it to TSR. They gave the name the working title of Spy World, named after Gamma World, TSR's post-apocalyptic fantasy, published in 1978. The handwritten rules were submitted and eventually returned to him, with the hand-scrawled message, "Once this is typed, accept this manuscript." The scroll was signed by none other than Gary Gygax himself. He sent his rough manuscript to the typist, including one that had to quit because of a duck bill infection at the National Disease Laboratory in Iowa. Ducks, they're always involved. Eventually, the manuscript was submitted, accepted, and Rasmussen signed his first writing contract with TSR. It was Mike Carr who gave it the name Top Secret in 1978 and gave the instruction that a module be bundled into the box set. Merle was handed the Hill Giant Chief module and was asked to create something like it, but for espionage. At this time, Rasmussen had only a very sketchy understanding of RPGs. His only experience were those dorm room games of D&D. The early iteration of the rules had the games master or administrator as one of the player characters, like his early games. The module Rasmussen developed was Shrek and Harlanstella, the place where the East and West met during the Cold War. When the game was eventually published in 1980, it proved a great success with an initial print run of 10,000 copies, selling quickly. Thanks to this success, Rasmussen joined TSR as a staff writer and contributed to the basic D&D line, the solo books, as well as Boot Hill and Star Frontiers. And he produced a Top Secret companion in 1985 to satisfy the desire of players to have more and more stats for guns. The companion also provided some background material to support character generation that's lacking in the final edition of the rules. By 1986, he was off the staff, working as a technical writer for Human Resources, when he sold the rights to his work to TSR. They produced a significant revision of the game, written by Rasmussen's former colleague, Douglas Niles, Top Secret SI, SI standing for Special Investigation. It provided a richer, more detailed background for adventures, more detailed car chase rules, and different professions or classes for player characters, and a more slick art direction. Rasmussen was outside of the gaming industry for years before returning to play Top Secret again in 2014, reconnecting with the hobby and running Top Secret to adoring fans and new players. He's currently developing a new espionage game, codename Acrid Harold. If you search hard enough, you'll find a playtest actual play podcast online. In this updated game, he tackles the global uncertainties of the world post-war on terror. Look out for it on a personal server, because you never know when the feds might come knocking.
Just by the rules!
Welcome once again. You join us in a discreet location in London's Mayfair, an exclusive gentlemen's club, where the great and good gather to network through the means of waggling the old school tie in return for favours. Joining me from my alma mater is Judge Blythe. He's a so-called judge, sitting here with his talisker and single ice cube made from the waters of the Western Isles. Hello there, Judge Blythe.
Hello there, Dirk.
Okay.
Love him just waggling the tie. What do you want to say then?
It's not that kind of gentleman's club.
Not that kind of gentleman's club, no.
Today we've got together to discuss the finer points of the game mechanics of Top Secret, an espionage role-playing game for three or more players, okay? So what are your overall thoughts, Judge Blythe? What do you make of Top Secret?
Well, it's a funny one, isn't it? There are some good bits, which I will cover.
Okay.
But overall, I found it's a little bit of a frustrating system, because it's incredibly table heavy. There's table after table after table. There's even tables within tables. I think at one point, you roll for a combat outcome and it says something like light wound, and then you roll on another table to see how bad the light wound is, how much damage the light wound is. I mean, you just think, good Lord, how many tables has this game got? And it did kind of remind me of something someone once said to me. I remember years and years ago when we were younger, that, you know, you can always tell a good game from a bad game, or a good game, a good system from a bad system, on the number of tables. The more tables it's got, the worse the system is. And I'm not sure, might not be true, because we do like tables, don't we? I mean, Runecast, we like the fumble table,
yeah.
We like the resistance table. Tables can be fun. You know, they have a few tables in and say, oh, hang on, something bad's happened, you're going to have to roll a D100 and see. So I'm not disregarding the notion of the table altogether, but I think in Top Secret, you have to roll a lot of tables to do anything. Yeah. I mean, you really do. It's almost funny. I mean, there were points when I was rereading the rules, and I was kind of started laughing almost hysterically to myself, to think, God, this is like a joke. Is this a joke game where they're making you roll endless tables that lead you nowhere? It's a bit like a Bond villain's attempt to bring down the world of role-playing. Oh, Mr. Bond, people enjoy role-playing games, but I've invented a game that'll ruin role-playing for everyone because they'll just have to roll on tables endlessly. But I was thinking the Game Master's screen would be like the Berlin Wall. Is that big? That many tables? It's unbelievable. So there was that, and it does have some redeeming features, and it is interesting in an historical context to look at it, because it gives a certain picture of the time and what games were doing, and what people, maybe the people who designed it, were trying to do, and you can, there are some elements to it that I do appreciate, but in an overall view is, wow, there's a lot of tables.
Okay. I'm going to have that printed on a t-shirt. Tables can be fun,
but not too
so many. What are the three rules that you're going to pick out for us to discuss?
Well, one rule I liked in, do you want to list all three?
Yeah, list all three, and then we'll go through them. That's how it works. We've been doing this for 20 episodes.
I'm sorry, it's because we're in the Gentleman's Club and I've had too many Taliskers and I'm not paying attention, sorry. Character statistic generation, or primary traits, primary personal traits as they're called, but stats.
Yeah, yeah.
Stats. The stats generation system is interesting, I think.
Okay, well, have a look at that.
I think the NPC reaction table.
The NPC.
There is a table for it. Unsurprisingly, there's a table for NPC reactions. But that's quite interesting, even though it is a table, but it's interesting in terms of what it's trying to do. I think finally, fame and fortune points are an interesting thing as well. They're an interesting aspect of it.
So there's three interesting things.
Three interesting things
that you're going to pick out, though. Okay. So let's put this on the table. Okay.
Yeah.
Top Secret's in the dark, and I think that this game is a thing of genius.
Do you? You're speaking in the defence.
I'm speaking in the defence.
Well, overruled. I'm a judge. Overruled. That's the end of that. Anyway, moving on.
Well, let's see how we go.
Okay.
Now, I'm very aware that people may not be familiar with this game because, you know, we've dealt with the big ones, haven't we?
It's a little bit obscure, I suppose.
Yeah. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to ask you to roll a character. Let's look at these personal traits now.
Okay. Yeah.
You're going to be an agent. Have you got a name?
When you play a fantasy game or science fiction game, weird names roll off the tongue, don't they?
Yeah.
You know. But when it's a real game, like Cthulhu or something like this, I always kind of struggle, because I start thinking real people with those names who I don't like. No, I think, oh no, don't call him that. Don't call him this.
They always have names like Jim Steele, and things like that.
Or you give them a name that's a real name, you think it's all right, and then three sessions in, you think, oh my God, that's that kid at school, I couldn't stand, isn't it? Oh no, I like this character.
The great thing about this is that it doesn't give you any names in the book, does it? It doesn't really give you anything in the way of
gives you a lot setting. Of tables.
Gives you a lot of tables, but it doesn't give you...
It's not got a table for character name. It should do.
it doesn't give you much in the way of context setting, and I think that's part of the trouble. I think the thing to say up front is that it's not an easy read.
It's not. I mean, I have to say, when I read it, I'm not sure... conjured up or recreated the feeling of being a spy.
Yeah.
But it certainly recreated the feeling of being 12 years old with my first role-playing rule book and thinking, what the heck's this?
Yeah.
It certainly is. It is not... But I think inspiring or interesting.
I think, bear with it, because I think the joy of this is in the playing.
Yeah, well, it is
with it's not in the reading.
It is with most things.
Yeah, and for that reason, I'm going to invite you to create a character. Okay. So let's get cracking. So the personal traits are created by rolling a D100, so it's 1 to 100.
What I like about what they're trying to do is it tries to get around the idea of a really, really bad roll. Because we've all created characters, haven't we? With a traditional 3D6.
Yeah.
And then we've rolled a 3 or a 4 or a 5. And everyone, there's been an awkward moment then, hasn't there, where the games master thinks, do I let him re-roll that because it's dreadful?
Mm-hmm.
Or do they have to stick with it? Try to overcome that, and that's quite admirable, I think.
Therefore, my first point, before you start rolling,
mm-hmm.
Your Honour, I'm going to say that's the first thing of genius. It points out that your play characters are something special and above the norm. That's point one. I want that on the record.
But what I would go on to say...
roll up dice. I'll let you have your point in a minute.
No, you won't. Shut up. The point is...
Yeah.
That's what's so sad about it. It has little glimmers of genius, and then it just drifts off into stupid tables. Anyway, we'll come on to that.
Yeah.
Go on, right, I'll roll. Physical strength.
Yeah.
You ready?
This is a measurement of your muscular strength.
Get away.
Okay.
54.
So I look on the table.
You're looking on the table.
And you get plus 10.
So
64.
Right.
Okay. Charm.
Charm.
Yeah. Oh, a high roll. 82. Is plus
5.
87. So in the quirks of this system, if you roll a 90...
Yeah, that's a bit stupid.
You're better off because 91 to 100, you don't get any
additions. Yeah, you roll a 91. You're better on a 90 than a 91, aren't you?
Mm. Willpower. Okay. This is your willpower. Perseverance.
Okay.
68. And so that means that it bumps up by 10.
Okay. Yeah.
Courage.
Courage.
This is your reaction in the face of danger.
86. Oh, he's a good character, isn't he? I don't need these.
Yeah.
86.
Plus 5.
Plus 5.
91.
Wow. Knowledge. He is James Bond.
He is.
Isn't he? Not so bad. 74.
74 plus 5.
Ooh. Yeah.
And coordination. So this is
70.
Dexterity and quickness plus 5. Now do you want to play?
I want to play this character. He's great. He's the best character. I think I just ruined my luck now. For all the brilliant character, I rolled duff ones forever onwards.
So that shows how your primary characteristic bumped up. And then you have a series of secondary.
Which are generated from that. That's right. But I do think, I like it. I do like that rule, because I think it's quite innovative, particularly for what, was it published, 1980?
Right. Yeah, 98.
I think it's innovative because it does get round that idea of the bum roll that is always a bit stupid, a bit awkward. You know, no one ever lets you roll a 3. So why bother?
Right, the other way of developing your characteristics now, I'd like you to have a roll on a couple of these. So let's get your age.
Another table?
Yeah, there's another table on here. I've got my rule here because there's a lot
of tables, everyone.
Yeah. Right,
I think the evidence for the prosecution is mounting up here.
ten-sided dice, go on.
Or 10-sided dice?
Yeah, go on.
Okay.
So,
age?
So
2.
Okay, so roll it 3 times, sorry. Roll a 10-sided dice 3 times.
3 times? 2. Right. 7, 8, 9, 7, 12, 15, that's 15.
15, right. Okay, add 12 years.
What?
So add 12 days to that.
27,
okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, you need to roll a
10. Can I just pick one? Can I just pick an age? Go on, sorry, I've thrown you now, haven't I? It's so much fun, Chris, you're right. It's so much fun, isn't it?
All right then.
Let's get a genius. Go on.
Let's go on.
Don't. I want to know what my age is. Can carry on.
That's it.
27.
27. Yeah. Okay. 27.
All right.
Okay. For every 5 years over 50, you'll lose 1 to 10 points in both physical strength and coordination. Because these figures go up and down, don't they?
Mm.
Now, part of the trouble, I think, in the rules, in the run of the rules, is that these personal traits don't really come into it. If you look, if you read the rules,
yes, they just—that's right. They kind of, they don't, do they really?
No, because like things like I don't know if you go in, you fall out of a boat. It's determined by a table rather than by these primary attributes. Yes. So,
and this is what I mean. That's a little bit sad about it. That it starts off very well, rolling your character. You think,
but you know that that sadness will be eliminated. As soon as you introduce players, and what players will do, they'll use those primary traits to determine it. They won't use a table to determine whether there's a shark in the water.
Well, maybe not, but the game says you do.
Yeah, but in the run of play, you would do it. You would have fun with those percentages.
You would, but...
Anyway, we need to find out whether this character's got glasses.
Okay, this is a good roll. This is an exciting roll, isn't it?
Yeah, roll a 10-sided dice. Now, this isn't in the form of a table, but it could have been. Go on.
What is it?
Go on, roll your dice.
2.
Okay. You wear glasses.
Do I?
Right, okay. Right, just take my glasses off to read what you have to do now. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So, your character wears glasses. Now, roll a roll another 10-sided dice. This is fun.
It's a table for
this. This is what they want. No, this is what they want. Go on.
One.
You've rolled a one. You can't wear contacts.
I won't go along with that. I've never liked the idea. So put yourself in the eye every morning.
Yeah. You know? So you might be able to kill people with your bare hands, but you can't stick your finger.
Can't stick a finger in me on that.
Okay. Now in this game, you can't pick your areas of knowledge.
No.
You have to roll on a table.
You have to roll on a table.
So. Roll a percentile dice.
Another table. I have to say to anyone listening, if you like tables, this is the game for you. I mean, I don't, but if you do.
It's good that you're already getting a flavour of who this character is, aren't you?
There is a bit of that to it, yeah.
Yeah.
44
is geology. So you're attuned with rocks. Roll again.
70.
Religion. So rocks and religion. You're a spy, you're an agent, can do.
He's in a rock gospel band.
He's in a rock gospel band.
That's his cover.
Okay, roll again.
45.
Home economics.
Do I remember that? I think we re-rolled that when we were creating a character with Simon, and I think Simon said very knowledgeably. I don't know if this is true. Very knowledgeably. Oh, yeah, James Bond's a good cook.
Yeah.
And we both went, oh, right, okay. That's all right then. But it's home economics. It doesn't say
cooking.
Cookery. It says home economics. Does that mean you turn up with a basket with some eggs in to make jam tarts while you're doing school? You know?
You never know when it's going to come in, do you?
Home economics. Yeah. Bake a poison cake.
That's it.
Make a cake with a file in it.
Yeah.
To get them out of, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Already you're imagining.
Already, it's working, it's magic. Those tables are working the magic.
So the bureau classification is interesting. So these are the jobs you can do. So you can either, the adventures are built around this, aren't they? So section one is administrator.
Ooh, now, that's exciting.
You can't be an administrator.
Oh no, is that the games master?
The games master is the administrator. Okay. All right. But that goes back from the days when originally it was the administrator was one of the player characters, so the games master played the game. Section two, investigation. So, you know, you'd be the thing.
Okay.
Section three, confiscation.
Ooh.
Yeah. And section double O.
Double O, does it say double O?
Yeah.
Right.
Assassination.
Of course.
But
what would you wouldn't buy anything else, would you?
And so in each of these sections, so if your character wanted to be an assassin, you start at level 1 and depending on experience points, you would move up the rankings. Yes, yeah. You start off as a punk.
A punk. So you start off as a bit of a thug. Oh, it's a level, hang on, level two is a thug, isn't it?
Yeah, you're not
then
a thug.
Then a ruffian.
Whoa, whoa, don't get ahead of yourself.
Well, I know, but...
You haven't done anything yet.
Quite exciting, isn't it?
You're a punk until you're a thug.
Yeah, that sounds unpleasant, doesn't it, that sounds like some kind of hooligan who just kills people for money.
And then the next bit is you need to use your $400 to buy stuff on the shopping list.
Oh, right, okay. There we are. Let's have a look. So this is 1980s shopping list, is it?
Yeah.
Socks, $2. Is that right? That seems a lot. Back in 1980.
Well, socks are very...
It's a
luxury item.
Call out for American listeners. Does that sound realistic? $2 for a pair of socks in 1980? I wouldn't imagine they're $2 now.
Okay. So that's essentially your character built up, your agent built up. The only thing that you can determine without looking at a table...
Is the name.
There's a name.
Well, I could do with a table for that, because I'll name it after a kid I didn't like at school. That's the thing I could do with a table for, names.
And what arm do you use in real life?
My right.
Right, so your character's got right arm. Every character you have in Top Secret will be right-handed.
Is that what it says? Does it say that?
Yeah.
Because you're right-handed.
Because you're right-handed. This is a good way of determining his
age. It is, I suppose, isn't it?
So that's the first thing. We've shown the character creation and bump up stats. So what's the second thing that you wanted to look at?
Well, the second thing, there is a table in there for NPC reactions. And I think this is sort of interesting because it pushes a little bit on that idea, doesn't it, of which we all struggle with sometimes as a games master. I think it's how NPCs react, you know. So when you're running a game, you often have an idea in your head of how an NPC is going to react, and then the players don't quite play it as you imagine, and then you're caught on the hoof a little bit, aren't you? And you know, I've certainly been in situations where the NPCs reacted in a way that I've regretted afterwards. So I think it's a little bit sort of quite innovative in some respects. That they've put that in to push the idea of NPC reactions, particularly in a game where NPC reactions are probably going to be more significant because it's a modern day, if you like, role playing game, not crawling down a dungeon where your NPC reactions are going to be generally fight you, try and eat you, you know, that kind of thing.
So the way that this works is each of your contacts will have a trait. So when you come up against someone, they'll have a trait, and then you put your trait against it. So depending on your tactics or how you're going to encounter
approach them, that's right. Yeah,
will determine which of your attributes that you use.
Yeah.
So you may want to dazzle them. So by dazzling them, it's coordination. How would you
Was that card tricks?
Card tricks, yeah.
Card tricks, sure.
And then what you do is match your trait
against the reaction.
On a table
against their trait reaction. Character trait value, yeah.
Yeah. So and then you work down and each of the reactions has a code, and then you look on another table. And you'll get reactions such as, contact will listen to the agent. Then, admin's die roll will walk away. 1 to 30 will ask the agent to leave. 34 to 66 will ask the agent to shut up.
Shut up. That's not very imaginative. You've gone off this rule, actually. I'm thinking about it. No, it's not very good.
No, I think you're right. You see, this is my contention with it, Judge Blythe. My contention with this game, it is awkwardly written.
Yes.
But it's an attempt at this time.
It is an attempt.
It's an attempt at this time when, if you think TSR were producing the Dungeon Master's Guide, were trying to codify anything. Mm. So their instinct was to codify everything.
Yeah.
And we've already established that this genre, this type of game, is awkward.
Yes.
So you're meeting two awkward things. You're meeting an awkward thing that's hard to grasp, an awkward genre, and then an awkward series of game mechanic tools to deal with it. And I actually think this is a good attempt to try and make dungeon dwellers think differently about interactions and about how people might behave.
Yes, and that's why I picked it, because I think you're right, this particular rule does do that. It does try and push that idea of interaction. So rather than, you know, how you choose to approach them. See, that's the key thing, isn't it? I think D&D, first edition, probably has rules in about how monsters are going to react to you and that kind of thing. But what this does is it pits your approach against their reaction. So your approach is what matters.
Yes.
As well. And I think that is quite clever, that it's pushing that idea. It does it in a sort of slightly clumsy way. And there's also a whiff of, as we discussed earlier with Simon and his obsession with solo games, there is a whiff of the solo game about it, isn't there?
Yeah,
as if you could almost play this game by yourself and think, right, okay, my character's going to approach this contact in such a way, and I wrote, because I've got a table to roll on, the table will tell me, rather than the games master, or administrator in this case, what will happen. So there's a little bit of solo play, but you're right, it is that attempt to... It's a different view of role-playing games than the view that people have now. It's trying to, you're right, codify the world through a game. And because the world that Top Secret exists in is a more complicated world, because it's a real world, that seems to have led to more tables, because there's more to codify.
Yes.
Than there is when you're down a dungeon hitting things with a sword. And that's, in a sense, that's what's good about it. And I can see why you find it appealing. But in a sense, that's what kind of, for me, cripples it a bit as a game, because it's over codified. And I must admit, when I read through it, my heart did sink. There were points where I thought, oh my God, I cannot bear any more of this, because it's just ludicrous amount of tables within tables. I mean, there's even a table for sort of executions, isn't there? So if your character's executed, you roll a D100 and it's got a range of methods of execution, from hanging to poisoning to scorpion. It was a scorpion sting, and you think, well, what's this about? Wouldn't a games master worth his salt think, okay, you've been captured by, I don't know, Baron von Goldfinger, so he's going to shoot you or kill you with a laser. Whereas if you've been captured in the desert by some tribesmen who are going to execute you, they're going to use a scorpion, you wouldn't roll on the bloody table, would you? You'd roll on the table and go, right, you've been captured in the desert.
And that's
they're
precisely...
They're going to wait. They've ordered a laser by mail order. They're going to wait till that arrives to kill you. And then, no word of a lie, there's a survival roll. So you roll on the table to see how you're going to be executed. And then there's a survival roll to see if you survive the execution. And you think, this is weird. It's weird.
But isn't that precisely what would happen in the run of play? And although it's presented as a table, what it's actually doing is making you think about, okay, within, as a games master, these are the array of executions that blow
fell. That's you speaking now. I don't think in 1980 when people read this game they were thinking that. It's trying to push them in that direction, but I think it's got to look at the words on the page. What it's saying is, in this game, if you're going to be executed, you roll the table.
Well, I think
that's just daft.
But that's just looking at the rules as written. I think in the run of play, I can see how in the 1980s this would capture the imagination of people who picked it up. Because
I think you are looking at that with a much... You are using your very sophisticated and very experienced role-playing brain. You're looking at Top Secret with a sophisticated role-player's brain that has played a lot of role-playing games, different types of role-playing games over the years. And that's fair enough. There's nothing wrong with that. But what I'm saying is, if you looked at this in 1980... I think I'm not sure you would have those perspectives, because those perspectives are very much with hindsight, aren't they?
I disagree. What I'm saying to you is the exact opposite. Mm. That I can see that, okay, I'm experienced as a player of games, and my experience of playing games is through charts and tables.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm interested in espionage as a kind of adventure setting. Therefore, I'm going to turn this into adventures for my friends. How do I do that? Actually, it's through these tables. Let me just, Your Honour, if I can just present this table of missions.
Oh, yes.
Because I think this table of missions is good. Now, the way this is presented is to award experience points.
Yes. Yeah.
But in actual fact, what it actually helps the administrator / GM do is create an adventure.
Yeah.
So you can...
A random dungeon generator.
It's a random dungeon
generator. We know what we think of those.
We know what you think of those.
Well, I think you agree that, Sam. But we'll wave that through.
Hang on, let's look at the case in point. You can't look at case law in this.
Well, I think you can.
So I'll give you an example. So for example, if you pick out an assassination in here, what it'll actually do is then give you a series of codes. So it'll say, there's a lot of columns. There's 1, 2, 3, 4,
there's eight columns.
Ooh. Okay. So in the briefing information, if I look under A, you'll be given the identity of the human target, B, the latest location of the target. The information that will be withheld is E. So look under E, this number of persons present.
You won me over now.
But you don't need to know that, do you, as a player? Me as an administrator sitting at home, how am I going to create fun for my friends? I'll look on here and think...
Well, that's an interesting point as well. I think what's not entirely clear about the game, and maybe it's intentionally not clear, is whether these things are done in the run of play or beforehand. I mean, some of the tables, you do wonder, is the idea that you play it without any prep and you roll tables and roll dice? And again, it comes back to that solo play thing of, you know, you would roll on a table, you'd sit down in the evening and go, right, we're going to play Top Secret, you've got your characters, right, I'm going to roll on the mission table, everyone, and see what we get.
Yeah.
You know? And do you do it like that? Or do you roll on the table in advance as a way of preparing? This thing that's not quite clear, you know, is that table to kind of stimulate your imagination? Which I can imagine it would do, because if you do, there is that thing when you roll on tables and things come up that you don't expect and you think, oh, that's interesting. I can see that. But I think the problem is you can look at some of these tables in isolation. As I said earlier, we all like a good table. But I think it's just there's so many. I mean, when you get into combat, I just, oh my God, you know.
Yeah, we should mention combat briefly. So,
well, it's hard to mention it briefly, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It does go on. It's very, very cumbersome, I think.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, what it does attempt to do is to try and describe blow by blow, granular combat. I mean, if you like crunch, it's about as crunchy as a crunchy thing. It's like a crunchy wrapped in a...
crunch bar.
It's
a crunchy.
It is crunchy. maybe we'll talk about that later. But...
we have to.
Okay. Let's look at your third one.
Third one is the Fame and Fortune points.
Fame and Fortune.
I'm not sure if this is an optional rule, actually.
It is an optional rule.
But it is interesting.
If you look at the history... In historical context of Top Secret, this is often quoted as one of the innovations.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I think that's true, and it has, and it's kind of something that's filtered into other games because fortune points.
Yeah.
I think you roll a d10, and the administrator keeps a secret, so you don't see how many fortune points you've got. But at various points in the game, and I don't think you get any more back, do you? Once they use, they're used. And then it allows you to actually roll dice again and things, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So it's a bit like luck points, which I've sort of peppered all through modern role-playing games, aren't they? Luck points, fortune points, all Bennies. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it is very innovative idea and a clever idea, you know, that you've got these luck points. It's the idea of your luck running out, you see. You don't actually know when your luck's run out because the administrator has the total, which is, again, quite a good idea. It's quite good fun, isn't it? You think you're going to be lucky again, but you're not lucky. You've run out. You only had six, and this is your seventh time.
I suppose this is allows you to have feats of heroism, isn't it? So it means that you can do the thing of, you know, you get shot by a bullet, but it's hit... you know, a Bible in your inside pocket.
It's that kind of thing, isn't it? You know, which you see in sort of James Bond all the time, don't you? Where he's lucky, you know, you're lucky and that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah. I think, see, this is where I think fame and fortune points are the thing that kind of reiterate my feelings about the game.
Mm.
Notwithstanding the fact that it is an awkward read, it is difficult to read. Yeah. But I think it's a narrativist game trapped within a simulationist rule set.
You've sold it to me now. You should have gone into advertising with phrases like that, shouldn't you? Buy this. It's a narrativist escape trapped in a simulationist game. I'd have bought it. If that had been on it, I'd have bought it. I take back everything I said. People will be ordering it now on eBay. They're trying to get hold of it as we speak.
And with that, I'm going to put that down as a win.
Yeah. Overruled.
The White Dwarf. Redacted. Dragon. Normally, this part of the podcast, we would turn to our good friend, at Daily Dwarf, from Twitter, to trawl through the back issues of the heyday of White Dwarf to find choice pieces to illustrate the game under discussion. But Top Secret only appeared in adverts. Dragon, on the other hand, was very fulsome in its support of the game. It was the TSR House magazine, and Mel Rasmussen was a TSR staffer who was on hand to develop rules for his game through the monthly publication. Along with others, he made regular contributions, expanding the rule set and offering supporting material to help flesh out the setting. When it comes to Top Secret, I think there's a definite distinction between the rules as written and the rules as played. Outside of the rules, the game's developed a life of its own, and it's very popular with players who demanded more from TSR. Of course, much of this additional material took the form of hardware and weaponry. Sniper rifles, grenades, landmines, machine guns, missiles, even the effects of nuclear weapons were covered. The last thing that Top Secret needs is an increase in proliferation of rules to add to the corridors of its labyrinthine combat tables. And the bloodlust was apparent in the reader questions. How much does a flamethrower inflict? What are the statistics for an M60 light matching gun, an M14 assault rifle, an MP56 submachine gun, an 81mm M29 mortar, 105mm M102 howitzer, a red-eye shoulder-fired missile, rifle grenade launchers, an M60 tank, a Patton tank, an M1 tank, and a Northrop F5 Freedom Fighter? Phew. The terse reply was, the Top Secret game is not a military role-playing game. Official statistics on military ordnance are not available. In retrospect, it's possible to see that in some quarters, the game was seen as a means of introducing guns and ammo sensibilities to D&D, murder hobos in tuxedos. But the game had other ambitions. In issue 40, the Rassaman Files was a regular Top Secret column where design secrets were shared. Some of the original material that didn't make the final cut were printed with commentary. His design notes, when researching the genre, included a comprehensive flowchart that illustrated some of the narrative directions that could be found in Napoleon Solo, Maxwell Smart and Derek Flint adventures, as well as others from TV and film. This flowchart took the character from creation, proceeding through a series of narrative events, step by step. This supported the original concept where the administrator would be a player who was competing with the assassins and confiscators. The administrator was elevated to the status of a regular games master during the playtesting so that the random interventions of players could be accommodated. However, this flowchart gives a sense of how Rasmussen had an eye for the structural development of interesting storylines, rather than just the crunchy mutual annihilation apparent on the surface of the rules. The flowchart was abandoned and not included in the rules. However, the experience table gave a hint of this earlier concept. The table provided a list of missions with codes that gave the GM possible elements to develop in the adventure. In issue 61, Gary Gygax himself contributed a new bureau classification, Infiltration, complete with its own list of possible missions. This was a class that was developed in his home game, played with his son Luke. The mission list generates stories on the fly, such as infiltrate a student group, identify the leader. There'll be complications such as false information. Dragon also provided a technician class so that agents could tackle missions using tech and gadgets. Again, the rules don't really provide any details on the benefits of progression through these classes, but they're used to define the types of operation that will be fun to play, and some of the narrative complications that might be encountered. The classification bureaus are key to understanding Top Secret's narrativist intent. In Dragon 47, Rasmussen provides more granular descriptions of the special classification within bureaus that are provided in the rules. These are more of a colour to give to the characters. So, for example, a magician in Spy Talk is an agent experienced in investigation and confiscation, who's an escape artist, a master of disguise. Or there's a mechanic, a spy whose job it is to create accidents. Or a hunter who's skilled at hiding in shadows and tracking targets. This style of character building descriptions appear 30 or so years later in Ken Hite's spy thriller emulator, Knight's Black Agents, for the Gumshoe system. But what about scenarios? It's the adventures where a game usually comes to life. Most of the early Top Secret modules didn't serve the system well. The early ones are framed more as military missions suitable for mercenaries rather than espionage. The scenarios in Dragon were similar. In issue 39, for instance, the missile mission involves player characters taking on the role of two rival agencies from Russia and China who were seeking the secrets of a NATO superweapon. In issue 48, there's plans for a secret underwater base with the title Dr. Yes. All the plans are there, even down to the air conditioning system. The highlight of these scenarios for me were the final contribution from Rasmussen. Operation Zodiac was a series of scenario ideas about space travel, which were complemented by special rules which included new attributes for dealing with zero gravity. There's also plenty of background supporting material about different space agencies too. But something moribund about the subject matter is at the time it was published in 1987, the space shuttle program was paused following the Challenger disaster, and battles against the KGB in space seemed to reflect an earlier time. However, the mode of constructing the different scenario hooks demonstrated how the experience table had transformed as a means of presenting scenario ideas. For example, codenamed Taurus, a satellite in the payload has been tampered with so that the astronomical tool can be transformed into a surveillance device. The complication was that a rival mission from the Soviets was going to shadow the NASA mission in order to take control of the satellite. It's all fascinating and detailed and exciting stuff. Dragon continued supporting Top Secret SI when the new edition came out, including an article celebrating the potential of the new advantages and disadvantages mechanic in the character creation, written by Marcus L. Rowland, a writer more famous for his contributions to White Dwarf. At Daily Dwarf is right. Everything does come back to White Dwarf.
Starburst memories!
This is a brand new section of the Grognard Files. Back in the day, our cultural touchpoints were three journal tentpoles. White Dwarf, 2000 AD, and Starburst magazine. Published in the UK by Marvel, it was our version of Starlog. Every month, we would study it to discover the latest incarnation of Caroline Munro and what films and TV we needed to seek out to inform our gaming. I've devised this overly complicated audience participation. So what I've asked you to do, Blythe, I think you've got a list there of 10 spy sequences film and television.
Another table.
You got another table.
Another table in the spirit of Top Secret. Cool. Yeah.
So you got a table there of a 10. And I've got 10. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what we're going to do in this overcomplicated segment is we're going to roll on a D10 each of us. Yeah. And then we're going to describe a sequence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we're going to talk about how it could inform games, how it could work in the games. Right? And then after we've run the spy episodes, which will be in about 12 months' time. We're going to run a poll.
Okay.
And the results of that poll will determine which sequence patrons would like to see recreated in an actual play using a system of their choice.
Okay. Pay attention, Bond.
Pay attention. Yeah. Pay attention, Bond. Okay. So, we're going to roll on this table. Have you got your table? I'll let you go first.
All right, okay. Here we go. Oh, that's a 7.
It's a 7. Okay.
007.
007. So what's your pick? What have you got there?
Well, 7 is the scene in Casino Royale. The new Casino Royale, not the parody version. The Daniel Craig Casino Royale.
That's a pity, because I like the one with David Niven.
You like one David Niven.
And Woody Allen is little Jimmy Bond.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. But no, it's not that one. It's the Daniel Craig version. And it's the scene in the stairwell of the hotel.
Oh, yes.
Where the two kind of, they're mercenaries. He fights them, he kicks one down the stairs, so one falls down the stairwell and is killed instantly, and the other one he kind of grapples with, doesn't he? And there's this long scene where he's got his arm around his neck and he sort of slowly strangles him, and the guy's feet are kicking, and it seems to go on forever, and it's quite an unpleasant scene. And I remember watching it and thinking, blimey, this is a James Bond film. And you know, you're normally used to James Bond dispatching people fairly quickly with a comical quip at the end of it, you know. So when Sean Connery throws the electric fire into the bath and he says, oh, shocking, you know, you're used to that, aren't you?
Yeah.
But that's not what you get in this film. What you get is James Bond really kind of wringing the life out of this guy.
Yeah.
And it's unpleasant. And then afterwards you've got the scene where he kind of downs all the scotch, a big glass of scotch, and you can see the effect that this has had on him. And you've got the Bond girl, Vesper, haven't you, watching it, and she's kind of shocked. And it's an interesting scene, because there's a real sense that he's killed someone, and that person didn't want to die, because people don't.
No. I think it was Alfred Hitchcock, wasn't it, who put forward the idea that it's very hard to kill a man.
Yeah.
And in Torn Curtain, there's this scene where there's like this intense battle where they're trying to kill
him.
And it is like that. I think it's a statement of intent as well, isn't it, that film of the modern era, to say, post-Bond.
We've done with Bond kind of being a slightly comic character or a lightweight character, and we've done with the idea of killing people being almost funny, you know.
Yeah. So what about in terms of gaming then, this scene?
Well, it's interesting, because it is a difficult... There's two difficult things in there that I think are difficult in role-playing games. One is unarmed combat. So you've got this grapple, haven't you, and this strangulation thing, which a lot of role-playing games don't really cover very well. You know, they often... You know, shooting, hitting people with swords, that kind of thing. but actual the nastiness, I suppose, and the trickiness of that kind of unarmed combat and brutality of it,
yeah,
is difficult to replicate in a role-playing game, isn't it, I think? And I suppose the other thing that's difficult to replicate in a role-playing game, and I think goes back to your comment about why, you know, maybe why I'm a bit cool on role-playing games set in the here and now, is the sort of guilt that Bond seems to feel, that she's horrified by what he's done. He feels a bit bad because he sees that reflected back at him, that what he's done is quite brutal. And although, albeit necessary, because these guys are going to kill him if he doesn't kill them, Vesper's appalled by it, she's upset yeah. by it, he's a bit upset by it. And those things are difficult in role-playing games because invariably those elements are what make modern-day films interesting.
Yeah.
But in a role-playing game, there never is that guilt because it's a role-playing game.
Yeah.
And I think those two aspects are difficult to replicate.
Yeah. I think the unarmed combat thing, I think you're right with that. I think with the psychological thing, Night's Black Agent tries to do it.
It does. I was just thinking that. It does yeah. do that, doesn't it? It has a kind of sanity thing, doesn't it?
Where yeah, sanity. It also has like drive, so understanding what drive. Because that scene is very much like a rite of passage scene, isn't it?
Yes.
Where Bond is kind of coming to grips with his
role.
Because it's an origin story, isn't it?
It is really, They're kick-starting it again, aren't they? Rebooting the whole thing. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, coming to terms with the fact that he's a killer and coming to terms with the fact that some people might view what he does in a very poor light, which is what she sort of does. She looks at it and thinks that's horrific, as if he's a bit of a monster.
Yeah,
you know, and those things are difficult to replicate in role playing games. But I think what you said about Night's Black Agents is interesting. But I think that's the thing, isn't it? Where if you're playing a modern day role playing game set in the here and now with no fantasy, maybe that kind of thing is necessary to make it compelling as a game. And without that, it isn't as compelling as a fantasy game or a science fiction game.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the thing, I don't know.
Yeah. Especially, he's a bit of a monster, isn't he? Daniel Craig has got
psychopath.
He's got a face like a bag of spanners. I cannot understand for the life of me.
He looks like the long lost son of Sid James at times, doesn't he?
He does.
He does, I know, he does look
he's
like
that. The women fawn over him.
They do, don't they?
But he's got a face like a bag of spanners and a taxi with his doors open.
Yeah, he does look like, But I like him, though, because he looks like a killer.
Yeah.
I like that incarnation of James Bond, because James Bond is a killer. He is psychopathic, isn't he?
Yeah.
There was once a Channel 4 programme on top 10 psychopaths, and I think James Bond came in at number 4.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, at first you think, well, James Bond, a psychopath. Of course he is, isn't he? I mean, he's a cold
killer, the way,
isn't he?
Not the way that Bronham did it, is it? You
know? <It's Brosnan.
laughs> What was that?
But even when you look at... wasn't a hard act to follow, was it?
No, it wasn't.
Craig, to be fair.
And his invisible car. But I think that's the thing in...
You didn't see that coming, did you?
No, he didn't. And I think that's the thing, talk about the invisible car, talking about Casino Royale, the original one as a parody.
Mm.
In games, there's always a risk, isn't it, with espionage and spy games, that they do end up being a parody, because it's hard to keep players on track, because they kind of laugh at it, don't they?
Yeah, that's true. The minute you introduce a gadget, you know, I mean, we've done a little bit of it during this podcast, you know, immediately, there's loads of tropes and cliches in that, isn't there, that you can sort of... And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? You can use those cliches and jokes in fantasy games. It doesn't seem to take away from the fantasy, because we all know it's fantasy. But once you try and do a real-time, real modern-day espionage thing, you sort of don't want those jokes in. But they inevitably appear.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay. My turn to roll. And it's three.
Three.
Okay. This is interesting, because this is a similar... but very, very different sequence. And this is 3 Days of the Condor.
Oh, yeah. Robert Redford.
Yeah, Robert Redford. Now, there is somebody who is pure charisma.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, I would say
charisma
that.
Charisma 18.
Yeah. I would say that because I bear a passing resemblance to him.
He doesn't.
So this was Sidney Pollack's 1975 film. And The interesting thing in game term is that Robert Redford at the start of the film is part of a clandestine part of the CIA, who are a team of people who are reading magazines, books from all over the world, looking for codes or looking for some form of conspiracy buried within trash novels and magazines. And that's an interesting proposition for role-playing, isn't it? Mm. Because usually, as a spy trope, is that it's one individual alone, isn't it? So you're one individual alone in the world who has to fight things. But what it sets up in the first few scenes of 3 Days of Condor is that actually they could have a team of agents in this very discreet and esoteric corner of the CIA doing specific work. So I think that's interesting game term. But that doesn't matter, because whilst Robert Redford's out getting lunch, they all get killed.
Very TPK.
TPK.
Apart from Robert Redford.
Apart from Robert Redford. Yeah. Fairly early on. Yeah. Fairly early on. Max von Sydow, very efficient killer, comes in and kills them all in cold blood.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this is down to a report that has been sent up the chain of command by Robert Redford. And they're after him. Mm. They're after him.
Yeah.
And what follows is a series of cat and mouse. Now, the actual sequence that I've chosen is a sequence where he's on the run. He's trying to get away from whoever's killing them. It turns out to be the CIA.
He spoiled it for people.
It's like a rogue element within the CIA.
Isn't it?
Yeah. He can't turn anywhere for protection.
Yes.
And you know, like he says to everyone, "I'm not a field agent." You know. He's vulnerable. Yeah, he's set up as being vulnerable.
Not James Bond.
He's not very James Bond. He's the opposite of James Bond. And the sequence that I love, and it's very similar but very different, is the sequence when the postman knocks and it's the assassin. And the face-to-face in Faye Dunaway's apartment.
Mm.
And there's a scrap using improvised weapons.
Yes, yeah.
A jar of coffee. A poker, and he's there with, you know, and there's like this standoff, and it's like a blow by blow a battle sequence, hand to hand combat, that I think is a really good bit of the film.
Yeah, it's a good fight, isn't it? Like you say, although it's quite funny, he opens the door to the postman, doesn't it?
Yeah, you would never do it. A play character,
and that's when you through that as you watch it, you think you're on the run, and the postman knocks on the door. What could be so urgent? Surely
he lets him in. He lets him in.
Look, he's not a field agent.
The only time he becomes suspicious when he looks at his brown shoes, as though that's supposed to send you a clue.
That's an indicator, yeah. Increasingly more suspicious when he pulls a gun on him.
Yeah.
Oh, you're not a postman, are you? Yeah.
What I think illustrates something though about these two sequences that we've chosen is the importance of hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah.
I think now, I know that you're reading Feng Shui, aren't you, at the moment?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, now Feng Shui and modern games are all about quick resolution of combat, aren't they?
Yeah, and sort of flexibility and I suppose a bit of imagination in terms of what's happening. So it allows you to roll dice, and if you roll very, very well, you can describe certain combat actions.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I suppose, to put it simply, a very, very good dice roll allows you to, gives you permission to negotiate with the games master to do something spectacular.
Yeah.
So.
But what I think in these two sequences, I think it shows the power and drama of crunch.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And that, I think, to go back to Top Secret discussing in this episode, that's what that's trying to do. Now, there are loads and loads of tables to do with hand-to-hand combat.
Yes, there are.
And there's tables to determine what's allowable combat.
Yeah.
And the way it works is that if you're doing an offensive move, so say a judo move, you write it down on a piece of paper, and me as a defender, I write down two things that I can use against your offensive move, and we reveal them both at the same time. Mm. Then consult on the chart to see what it's like. Rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah, it is.
If devised by Stephen Hawking.
Yeah.
But I think what it's trying to do is replicate those scenes
Yes. It's acknowledging that in those kind of films and those kind of novels and that kind of genre, unarmed combat is a bigger deal than it is. It is a bigger deal than it is in other role playing games because you've got a sword or a gun. I mean, you might have a gun in Top Secret, but I suppose because it's modern day, there are instances where you wouldn't have a gun because you'd have to conceal it, and you know.
And I think we get frustrated by the level of granularity, the level of detail. But I can see how it's compelling. You know, that maybe fights shouldn't be resolved quickly. Maybe fights should have that grind to them.
Well, I think, and this is one of the kind of eternal RPG questions, isn't it? That you can argue it both ways, I think. There are systems where fights become a major event that can last for, in game time, and you know, an hour at the table for one fight. You know, RuneQuest, particular good example of that. Top Secret would be another. And then there's other systems that resolve things quickly. And you can argue it both ways, can't you? But there's something to be said for crunch, you know. And for a long time, although we've migrated a little bit onto games that are a bit more fluid and a bit quicker, but for a long time we were big fans of crunch.
Yeah.
You know, we played RuneQuest endlessly, and one of the things that we loved about it was the fact that you could have one fight in a session, and it felt like a big event with all sorts of things happening. You know, we've talked about it on the podcast, haven't we? And I suppose Top Secret does try and do that. But as I say, I think it's just that it's a bit cumbersome in the way it does it. It's too much referencing to tables. So it's that balance, isn't it, where it's good to have some crunch, but when the crunch starts to slow the game down and become a little bit ponderous and become a bit, you know, oh, hang on a minute, right, hang on. So you've rolled 23 and it's plus this, and you've rolled that, and then we just cross, just let me cross reference, and that's a B. Now B, what does B, let me just look at the other table, and B is this and that. And then the problem then is crunch is detracting from the excitement of the fight. That, you know, you're constant. I mean, and that's the problem. But I see what it's trying to do, and it's kind of a noble attempt to try and do that, you know, but it just falls flat a little bit.
I accept as well with some of this, the modifications are, I nearly said ridiculous, but that would destroy my own argument.
But there's an element of that to it, yeah.
About, you know, you get a modification on movement, range, type of weapon.
There's a little, it's not a table, but it's a list of modifications for drawing a weapon. If you draw it from a shoulder holster, it's minus something, and then if it's a pocket, it's less, and if it's this, it's that, and you're thinking, oh come on, I mean,
I keep it in
you
the could shoe.
Just have a yeah you just have a modifier for drawing a weapon, that's all you really need. I think that's the thing, it goes a bit too far in crunch, and that's the problem.
I think interesting game terms in both those sequences as well is that games master intervention, because the non-player characters intervene.
Yes.
So Faye Dunaway and Eva Green, they step in, don't they, and turn the balance.
Shift the balance
in there. So there you go. Anyway, that's our two sequences.
You know, in the Robert Redford scene, you know what you should do, shouldn't you? You should beat the postman to death with a table. That for an improvised weapon. Use a table, Robert. There's a lot of them about in espionage.
Okay, on that note, I think we should say, remind listeners to make a note of these two sequences, because we'll get a chance to vote on these. The next spy RPG we're going to look at in a few months' time is Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes.
Okay. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
There isn't another bit.
Well, I'll just close the file on this top secret episode. Please don't accept it from the courier if the seal is broken. Thanks to Simat and Andrew Smith for their help in this episode. I also recommend the Dead Game Society podcast too for their interview with Rasmussen. I really want to run a game of Top Secret because play's the thing, and I'm currently arranging the next online Grog Club session for Patreons. The podcast will always be free, but we run a Patreon campaign to support other activity. To find out more, follow the link on thegrognardfiles.com. We have some new Patreon supporters at the $5 level. Under a new backing level, they are now known as Armchair Adventurers with a three-piece suite and a luxury pouf. I like to roll the $5 backers something appropriate from a table as a virtual gift. And when it comes to Top Secret, there is an embarrassment of riches available. However, I don't think it's appropriate to roll on the execution table, so I'm going to reach for this bundle module instead that came with the box set. So this is Shrek and Hollandstella, that we've been talking about, and I'm going to roll on the Legends and Tips table. So you've given me a tip, now it's my turn to give you one. I did give you a warning that some of these might be red herrings. Okay, let me find a dice. Okay, and here goes. So first up is the artist Things Happen, who's made a contribution, so thank you. And I'll just roll at 12. Okay, a 12. A wizard in the basement of a bar knows that you're here and who you are. That's right, a wizard. So thanks, Things Happen. Next is Lee Carnell. Okay, and I've rolled 17. Okay, make a bid at the massage parlour and you may get more than you bargained for. Well, hey, I hope you have a happy ending there, Lee. Thank you. Okay, finally, this time it's John. I don't have any other details, but you know who you are, so thank you. Here we go. You get 20. A mechanical sea serpent inhabits the waterway. A mechanical sea serpent inhabits the waterway. Yeah, some of these are definitely fishy. Okay, thank you very much for that. If you join the Patreon at any level, you'll get a link to a download of the PDF of the zine, The Grognard Files Annual 2017. Thanks to David Patterson for pledging $2 a month, Juho Rutler for pledging $1.50, and Dale Hewson and Tim Olson for pledging $1. Tim Olson will be my guest in the next episode, which is a two-parter all about Citadel Miniatures and Games Workshop stores. Don't worry, we're strictly pre-slotter. Tim was the manager of the Dalling Road branch, and he has some great memories and great stories to tell about the Games Workshop back in the day. Until then, adios, amigos.